Hey everyone, I'm Ryan Kalamea.
And I'm Amy Gosha.
Welcome to The Divorce at Altitude, a podcast on Colorado family law.
Divorce is not easy. It really sucks. Trust me, I know. Besides being an experienced divorce attorney, I'm also a divorce client.
Whether you are someone considering divorce or a fellow family law attorney, listen in for weekly tips and insight into topics related to divorce, co-parenting, and separation in Colorado. Welcome to another episode of Divorce at Altitude podcast. I'm Ryan Kalamea. This week, I'm joined after quite a little break by Amy. Amy, what's going on?
Not much. I'm happy to be back doing our podcast together. And today we have an amazing guest. Her name is Kim Willoughby, and I just really admire Kim. She's a wonderful attorney. Really good at what she does. And I had the pleasure of working with her at her firm. So I'm happy to have Kim today. Kim, how are you doing?
I am doing great. Thank you. It's great to see both of you.
Yes. And I just wanted to kind of go into, you know, your background. So you focus on complex financial cases. You're a divorce attorney. You're an estate planning attorney. Is that correct?
That's right.
And Kim, you went to UVA, right?
For law school, I went to UVA. And then for undergrad, I went to Boulder. And I came right back as soon as I could after law school because I miss Colorado desperately.
Well, wahoo wah. I had a similar motivation to come back as well.
Yeah. And Kim did her undergraduate degree, I believe, at CU. Is that correct, Kim?
That's right.
Yeah. So you and Ryan kind of have an opposite, you know, background as accolades, I guess, in college and law school.
Right.
So it's exciting. Tell me about, like, what have you been doing during, you know, COVID, you know, not related to law? Like, what have you been interested in? How have you been spending your time?
Oh, gosh, trying to make sure that my teenagers got through it okay and learned how to do online school and online socializing. That was sort of a challenge. But for my kids, they ended up saying, well, if I'm going to have to do like sort of pretend school anyway, let me go do my sports. I have a son who has been playing hockey since he was 5, and he's now 17. So he went out to Lake Tahoe to hang out with a whole bunch of boys who were deep, deep, deep into hockey. And so he just did hockey for the year. And then my daughter, who is 15, she was obviously the younger child, and she got drug around to the hockey rinks so much as a baby in her little carrier that we just said, why don't you try ice skating? And 12 years later, she is down at the World Arena with a wonderful Russian figure skating coach and trying to train for as high as she can go in figure skating.
Wow, I can't believe that they have grown so much. So when I first met them, I think I was an intern for you in 2005. So how old would that have made your kiddo?
Would have made my son 2 and my daughter just born.
Oh my gosh. And now I have a 2-year-old. So time goes by. Well, I mean, you are an amazing attorney. You have a lot of really cool accolades. You know, just to kind of touch on those, you know, you're one of top 100 attorneys in Colorado, top 50 family or female attorneys in Colorado by Super Lawyers. You're also one of the best attorneys in Denver, rated by 5280 magazine. You're part of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. You've had several published appellate decisions. You know, what really drove you to really do all of these really cool things? And, you know, like your accomplishments are just really amazing.
Mainly it was being a frustrated professor. I was really meant to teach. And my father said, those who do, do. Those who can't do, teach. So I wasn't going to end up teaching. So I find a way to do it in my practice anyway. So I do a lot of speaking, a lot of writing, a lot of appellate work, because that's how I get that out.
And Kim, you're here to teach me in particular, but also our listeners on trust. So what is a trust?
So a trust in the estate planning context, it's a place where assets are held. So it's sort of a holding entity. And what it does is it separates out the person who has the control and the title of the assets versus the person who has the benefit of the assets. And so when you segregate out the control and the benefit, it allows for a lot of kind of cool things to happen, like asset protection in some cases, or an ease of estate planning in case of incapacity, or the ease of dealing with an estate when somebody passes away. And it also can provide a way for people to reduce their estate taxes in some cases, reduce their income taxes in some cases, and make sure that the people who, so if somebody puts something into trust for another person, can help make sure that the other person, the beneficiary, doesn't do something stupid with the assets.
And so as part of your practice, you do drafting of, you know, trusts and estate planning. What kind of trusts do you see in divorces?
So in divorces, we see all the different kinds of trusts. But the way I set them up in my mind is there's basically two big buckets or two big kinds and then two little shoot-offs from there. So the first one is what's called a revocable trust, or some people call them a revocable trust. But revocable means you can change things, right? So people will put things into their revocable trust and they can take them back out and they can trade things around and they can terminate the trust. It still is basically the person who puts things into a trust is called the settlor. It's still really their property, but you do it mostly for estate planning purposes and incapacity purposes. And then there's another bucket called irrevocable trust, which, as the name would suggest, is just the opposite. And that means you've put stuff in, the settlor has put assets into this trust, but can't get them back out. And most of the time also can't control them nearly as much or at all. So a revocable trust, that stuff is still mine. If I put something into an irrevocable trust, that stuff is not mine anymore. It is out of my estate. It is out of my control. It's just not mine and I really can't change it. And then within the divorce context, I further distinguish them between revocable trusts that are created by people outside the marriage. So for instance, wife's mom maybe created a revocable trust, and then revocable trusts and irrevocable trusts inside the marriage. So let's talk first about the ones that we see the most, and those are the ones outside the marriage. Or at least these are the ones that we have to pay the most attention to. So for instance, if I'm married to John and John and I are going to get a divorce, one of the things that in a divorce case is asked is there a trust where you are a beneficiary? And so if my mom and my dad, well, let's say my mom has a trust and I'm a beneficiary. And I know that because she's talked to me about that. I'm going to probably put down on my what's called disclosures, I'm going to say, yes, I'm the beneficiary of a trust, but it's a revocable trust. What that means is my mom has made me a beneficiary, but she can change it. She can revoke the beneficiary status for me. She can take everything out of the trust that she might have put into it, and she can otherwise completely change it and completely make it so that I never see a penny from this trust.
And Jim,
in that case,
and sorry to interrupt, but would you agree, is that pretty much the same as like a will as well?
Yep. In that case, John, my husband, does not get to know anything about that trust. It's not in play in the divorce. And it's just like a will. And so because it's just like a will, our law says the judge can't look at it. So John might say, this is ridiculous. I know because I've sat with your mom and she said she's going to give you $10 million from her trust when she dies. So I know you're getting that $10 million. Your mom likes you. You're the only child. I know you're getting this. It doesn't matter for the divorce because it's just like a will and she might change her mind and I might not get it. So the court can't look at it at all.
And Kim, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a case back in the day that said that the revocable trust did matter, and then the Colorado legislature changed that under 1410.113, right?
Yes, but you skipped a step. So what happened was this case came out and the estate planners said, oh my goodness, this is horrible. This is evil. This is not right. And we have a very liberal state anyway in Colorado in terms of what's included as property for divorce. And the estate planner said, no, we can't do that. And they changed that through the legislature very quickly.
And what if you'd said that, you know, John, or that your mom has told you that you're going to be the beneficiary of a trust? What if she hasn't told you and you're you know, the beneficiary of an irrevocable trust?
Always interesting. So if I don't know, I don't know. What I tell my clients, Ryan, is you're going to have to go ask. It's an icky question. It's not fun, but you're going to have to go ask, because this is something that if it comes up later, if John finds out about this later, then I'm going to be doing my divorce all over again. So it's better to ask the parent, get it out of the way now. Do I have an interest in an irrevocable trust? If the answer is yes, the attorney has more work to do.
So what kind of irrevocable trust do you frequently see outside or inside the family, whatever the case may be, when it comes to irrevocable trusts?
So for like these third party created trusts, pretty much always what they are is, back in the day, and it's about to become a thing again, we would do what's called a credit shelter trust or an AB trust. That's when mom and dad say, what we're going to do is when the first person dies, we're going to put all the money into one of two trusts. One of them is going to be called the marital trust, and it's for the surviving spouse. And then the other one is going to be called the family trust. And this is one that is for the family if the spouse doesn't use it. So the family trust one becomes irrevocable when, for instance, dad dies. Mom can't change it. Mom can mess around with the marital trust, but mom can't change it. And mom's not really supposed to go use the assets unless her marital trust has been depleted and she really needs it. So then there's this trust. Mom's still alive, so she can use it, but she can't change it. She can't make me not a beneficiary anymore. She can't take money out of it. She can't do anything with it except maybe use the assets while she's alive if she needs it. So what happens there is this is irrevocable, which means I'm definitely getting something when she dies. And then Colorado, that is marital property. So if dad died, he funds this family trust where I'm a beneficiary and it's irrevocable because he's dead. Then I have to go tell John about this. And then I'm going to have to do the work or have my attorney do the work to see if there's some value in there to me. And that's a very specialized valuation done by a forensic accountant. And the forensic accountant is going to go say, all right, mom's alive, but she's very old and she's probably going to die tomorrow. And you're the only child. So we know your basic, and these assets are just like, you know, stocks. So we know you're going to get this $10 million plus or minus when she dies. And that's going to be pretty soon. So we have to figure out what it was worth when dad died, what it's worth now, this now $10 million. And if there's an increase in that value, that will be marital property. And John can say, I want my piece.
And what's the normal reaction when you explain that to your client that John's going to get his piece?
You've got to be freaking kidding me. And then, you know, and it's more fun if mom lives in New York and then her New York estate planner says, well, in New York, this isn't property and you can't get a piece of it. And your court doesn't have jurisdiction over me to come like ask me questions, subpoena me, depose me or anything like that. And so it can become quite the interesting fight. There's lots of ways around that fight. And so I tell my client, look, you, at the end of the day, you're going to have to disclose this and it can either cost a real lot to get this done or it can cost not so much. So let's just do this.
So with the irrevocable trust, Kim, what do you normally see? Like, what are the normal irrevocable types of trusts that you see?
So for these third-party trusts, they're usually these AB trusts and one of the parents has died or a parent has died. There's some dynasty trusts that we come across. So grandma, grandpa, great-grandpa put money into a trust that can go on forever. And these things can go on for 1,000 years now. And that's, anyway, so they can go on for a long time. And then, you know, the spouse in a dynasty trust, what they can do is they can use it, but they can't ever really get it for themselves. So those are generally not in play. Sometimes mom and dad of the spouse will do what's called a QPRT or a qualified personal residence trust, where they have this really awesome expensive house. And the way that they have gotten it out of their estate for their estate tax purposes is they put it into this irrevocable trust that basically gives a kid shares over years. And if they live a certain amount of time, the whole house ends up in the name of the kid. And so I've seen divorces where you're sort of in the middle of that QPRT or you're at the end. And so you have to go value these houses and figure out if that beneficial interest has increased over the term of the marriage. You know, there's a million types of trusts now. And by a million types, I shouldn't really say it that way. There's lots of types of generic estate planning trust, ILETs, which are insurance trusts, life insurance trusts, irrevocable life insurance trusts, these CUPERTs, qualified residential trusts, CRETs and CRATs and GRITs and GRATs and lots of different things. But basically, they are just, the bottom line is it revocable or is it irrevocable as the first question, no matter what title is put on this particular type of trust. And then within those, there are irrevocable trusts that would be property for divorce purposes and irrevocable trust interests that would not be property. So this is where I say there's all sorts of different trust language these days. So whereas the legislature and the court systems kind of far behind in the types of trust and what kind of language we see, like the case law is meant for like the 90s. Now we have all sorts of different kinds of things that estate planners will put in trusts to A, make sure they're not property for divorce purposes, and B, make sure beneficiaries don't do stupid things. So our case law is, like I said, it's old, it's kind of stale, and it's not keeping up. There's not just like a trust, right? There's not just an irrevocable or revocable trust. There's a gazillion different kinds and they're for all different purposes and tailored for all sorts of families. And they're just like any other contract, sky's the limit in terms of how you construct them, in particular for those provisions that aren't about taxation issues. So again, in the divorce context, there's two kinds of irrevocable trusts, one that's going to be counted as property and one that's not. So the basic distinction between the two is if I, as a beneficiary, if I can go sue a trustee to get my stuff, to get my benefit, then it's going to be property. If I can't, then it's not. And an easy way of telling the difference is if the language in the trust is the trustee has the sole discretion to X, Y, or Z, then I can't go sue my trustee if it doesn't do something. I just have to wait around for my trustee to give me a benefit or not.
And would you say, Kim, in working with other family law attorneys, you know, you said that the case law is really meant for the 90s, you know, this gets pretty complicated. Do you find in every case where you have trust that other attorneys are having them reviewed to make sure that they're revocable versus revocable?
Yep. So I think that they're divorce attorneys don't do a lot of estate planning. They don't have to see a lot of estate planning. And so because these trusts are getting to be so much more exotic or new language, I think a lot of divorce attorneys look at them and say, I have no idea. And they will go to an estate planner to review and tell them about it. And, you know, I have spent a lot of time in the last couple of years being a liaison between the two practice areas. So I work with the bar association sections in both practice areas and try to get them to talk to each other. And I do this at the state level and the national level. And what I'm trying to do is explain in particular, well, both ways, but to divorce attorneys, look, get to your estate planning attorney quickly if you have any kind of trust, because it's not just, you know, give me an opinion of whether it's property or not. But how is this going to work? What are the things I should know about? What is the trustee really going to do here? How is this going to affect things for many years and maybe even outside my divorce? The thing about estate planning that's really made a difference in my practice is I don't see my families that I work with anymore as just one and done. You're in and you're out, and then I don't have to. These are families who keep going, whose issues keep going. And when I'm into their estate planning, now I can travel with them a lot further down the road and make sure things go as smoothly as possible for different generations and not just see this as, okay, here we are doing a divorce. It's not quite as easy as that a lot of time, in particular when there's sophisticated estate planning done by either the parties or their parents or their grandparents.
And Kim, you mentioned that we're going to be seeing a lot more AB and kind of we can get into kind of some taxation and political issues that drive this. Do you think it's fair to say that, I mean, there's kind of fads or different things that happen within estate planning, like at least you kind of referencing New York. I see a lot of Texas partnerships because of energy, and that was a big thing. And you saw a lot of partnerships, and, you know, you would get the Texas attorney that would say that this is bulletproof. the other person can't get into this. But then that changed, then irrevocable trusts or the, and it seems as if the kind of vehicle to transfer wealth from one generation to the other changes over time. And why is that?
Well, so right now we're in this precious little time when you can die and you can leave over $11 million and really close to $12 million to whomever you want without any estate taxes, right? But we know at the very least that at the very beginning of 2026, that $11 million is going to drop precipitously to somewhere about $6 million. The Internal Revenue Service came out with like a little memo that said to people, if you use your credit now, when you could use your credit, and then the credit amount you can use drops, we're not going to like claw it back. We're not going to say, hey, in 2021, you gave away $3 million and you could only give away $6 million when you died in 2027 or 2026. So everything over that next $3 million, we're going to take back. The IRS has said, no, you can use your entire $11 million. We're not going to say, oh, but you died when it was only $6 million. So we're going to go take that back and tax it as if you died with all of that. So what people are doing is they're saying we're getting our money out of our estate now when they have more than $6 million. We're getting it out now so that we can always try to make use of that $11 million. But, and this is really for the very wealthy, they're trying to get out $11
million. And a lot of it's driven by, almost all of it's driven by taxes, right? Tax policy.
Yep. So, and, you know, and to put the cherry on top with the new administration, there's the thought of we're going to get rid of all of these tax benefits for the super wealthy. And so maybe you don't even get the $6 million benefit. Maybe you only get $10,000. Bernie Sanders. So people are trying to move it out of their estates now before things change.
One specific question I had is, you know, in some of these trusts, you see a lot of generation skipping language. If you're a family law attorney, can you explain what that means and how does it really affect a divorce case?
It doesn't really affect a divorce case. So what the IRS wants to do is make sure at every taxable event, they get paid, right? So think of, I buy something that's a taxable event, they get paid sales tax. Somebody gets income, they get paid income tax. Somebody sells something, they get paid capital gains tax. So at any like taxable event, there is a payment. Death is a taxable event and has been for not ever, but for some years. And so they want to get paid at the first death. And they want to get paid at each generation. So if I give something to my son, I kind of know that if he still has it when he dies, he will give it to a next generation, but he will then be taxed, right? So the government wants to tax when I die, when my son dies, when my grandchildren die. If I were to just give a gift to a skip person, my grandchild, then I have skipped my kid. I've skipped a death. I've skipped a taxable event. The government doesn't like that. So the government gives you two different exemption amounts, one for skips and one for just your generic, just your lifetime credit amount. So, and sometimes they're the same amount and sometimes they're not. Right now they're about the same amount. But what it is the government wants both those taxable events. So when you're doing a gift tax return, you have to say, no, I've already paid the grandkids tax or I've used their credit. Because if you don't do it, you can get the grandkids tax twice for like 60, 70% instead of a mere 40%.
Yeah. And you had mentioned how it's really important and a best practice as a divorce attorney to have an estate planning attorney look at, you know, a trust when you're going through a divorce and to do that early. What if you do have that case where, you know, the trustee is in New York? You said there are some workaround ways to get information. You know, how do you go about doing that?
So there's uniform laws around like subpoenas so that you don't. So it used to be back in the days, we would do what's called letters rogatory, and we'd have to go hire attorney in New York to go get us letters rogatory that would allow us to ask questions, do a deposition of somebody in New York. Now there's like the Uniform Depositions Act, and it's not actually called that, but it's really close. And so you can just kind of go straight to the courthouse to get that subpoena. So it's a little bit easier. So there's still extra steps. You still have to go through a court that actually has jurisdiction over those people, but that can be done a little bit easier.
Kim, I want to ask, so you mentioned about that these could be done quite a while ago. What happens if a trust was set up, you know, a really long time ago and there's a long marriage and the trust has just grown and grown and grown? What do you do about the income or the appreciation on what is in the trust?
So depending on what kind of trust it is, let's say it's an irrevocable trust and it's not a discretionary trust, so it really is property. And when I was born, I was a trustee or a beneficiary. And now John and I are divorcing and I've been a beneficiary that entire time. And the only thing that's ever been in the trust was a brokerage account that was, you know, managed actively or sort of actively. So my beneficial interest will have increased over that time, and we'll hire a forensic CPA. We'll figure out what that benefit increase was. And it's not just straight look at the account balance then and look at it now, because I can't get to it. I don't have control over it. And maybe there's other beneficiaries as well. And maybe somebody else can tap into it, et cetera. But anyway, we're going to come up with a number. And we're going to say, this is the number of the increase in value over the time of the marriage. And I'm going to have to figure out how I get that value to my spouse. And sometimes it is just, hey, if I get a distribution, so my trustee sends me $100,000, I have to notify you and you'll get a piece of that $100,000. Or we have a house, I'm just going to give you the house and I keep my trust assets. Or when somebody passes away and I can get everything, then again, you will get a piece of that at that time. So you can do it in any of those ways.
And for our listeners that may not really understand the appreciation and why divorce lawyers say appreciation, does the whole trust, is it as if that is all on the table when it comes to a divorce? Or can you explain for our listeners, what does it matter that it's gone up or down or that's even on the table in terms of separate property versus marital property?
So in Colorado, marital property includes by definition the increase on separate property assets. So appreciation is always going to be marital, as is income. And that's the other thing. Most of these trusts are required really to generate income if they can. So the appreciation plus the income that happens since the date of marriage until the date of divorce is going to be in play as potentially marital property.
Now, if there was a revocable trust or there was a trust that has been, you know, spitting out income, I had a call with an estate planning on a trust just yesterday, and he asked me, has there been any distributions and why would that matter? Why is that estate planning attorney that I'm consulting with even asking that question to begin with?
All sorts of different reasons. So if the trust is not property for Colorado divorce purposes, then the distributions are just going to be gifts. So they're like nothing. They're just gifts. And then when the spouse receives them, if there's appreciation after that or there's income after that, that would be marital. But otherwise, they're just gifts when they hit, if the trust is not property for divorce purposes. If it is property for divorce purposes, then this is just income from a piece of property for divorce purposes. And this will probably also be marital property. But kind of an interesting thing is under our maintenance statute and under our child support statute, trust distributions are income for both of those. But there's no definition of trust distributions. So we think it's just whatever came out of the trust is going to be income. But within a trust, your distribution could be trust income and it could be trust principal. So there's a couple other levels of things to look at in theory. But then the other thing is when there have been routine distributions, or if the spouse is a beneficiary but is also a trustee and can write out their own checks and they're making distributions to themselves, that tends to change the way the trial court looks at these trusts and say, look, this is just your bank account that just doesn't have your name on it. You are able to make these distributions to yourself, and you've been making them to yourself at $30,000 a month for the last 10 years. So we're absolutely counting, you know, some piece of this beneficial interest as in play for divorce purposes.
So it's conceivable that there's an irrevocable trust that's discretionary, but that historically has given a lot of money to a spouse in distributions, and that would be concluded as child support or for maintenance. But then also, can you explain what the economic circumstance, you know, what that all means and why that matters, even if it's not property, that trust interest?
Yep. So sometimes we see the circumstance where we have the beneficiary, the trust beneficiary comes from a really wealthy family, right? And she hasn't ever had to get a job, so she didn't. So she does philanthropy, she does some art collecting. And so, and she gets married to somebody with no job and no estate of their own. And they have kids and there's no marital estate, because the trust is not property for divorce purposes because it's fully discretionary, but they've got these kids, right? And so a court says, but this thing has been kicking out $30,000 a month. And so A, we're going to count it for your income. And B, well, let's say there's a little marital property. Let's say there's $100,000 of marital property. Court is going to say, look, I'm giving this to him because he's got nothing. So all or a big part of this marital property is going to go to him because you've got $30 million that you're getting the benefit of over time. So this is your economic circumstance, and it makes me not divide what little marital estate there is 50-50.
Kim, I'm wondering if you've seen trust agreements that say that in the event of a divorce, the beneficiary gets like zero. What kind of language do you see where families have specifically drafted a trust agreement, or you may have done it in your practice because you deal with divorce? What are things that people do, and do they work?
They do work. So all sorts of things, Ryan, just like that. And that's what I was saying. You know, the estate planners are getting much more creative. And they're starting with the proposition that they're always going to be fully discretionary trusts, right? And then they just double down and they do things like they say, and if you're divorcing, trustee is not giving you anything. And if the Colorado court seems to think that they can do something else, we're going to move the trustee. We're going to move the situs of the trust. We're going to decant, which means we'll put it into a different trust that has worse terms. We're, you know, otherwise going to move this money away from the divorcing spouse and the courts of the divorcing spouse so that they cannot get a piece of it. And in a sense, that's perfectly fair when this money has come from grandpa, grandma, mom, dad. You know, their intent in giving this gift to child was not to give it to the spouse who's divorcing her. Their intent was to give it to their kid. And so courts do, to some extent, realize that's a fair thing. Grandma and grandpa get to do with their money what they want to do with their money. It gets dialed back a little bit when you have kids involved. And then that's where the courts will be more creative in trying to figure out how to make sure kids' lifestyles don't get severely reduced in one family's, in one parent's home as a result of the divorce because of what this trustee is doing. And it's a whole different ballgame if these are irrevocable trusts created by one of the spouses during the marriage, where the other spouse, like maybe used to be a beneficiary and now isn't anymore because there's a divorce. So these are called self-settled trusts. And then there's a lot of states that do self-settled asset protection trusts. Colorado doesn't do them, but our neighbors do. Wyoming does them, Nevada does them, South Dakota does them. And those are infinitely more complex, infinitely more challenging to the courts, and there's virtually no case law on them yet.
Well, Kim, obviously you know this inside and out, even though there are a million different ways to characterize something as a trust. For someone that, you know, maybe looking for more information, where can they find you? What's the best place to reach out to you and learn more about you and your firm?
So our website is www.willoughbylaw.com, W-I-L-L-O-U-G-H-B-Y. And that has our phone number and our email addresses and some information about our practice areas.
Well, Kim, I'm sure you have a hockey or ice skating appointment to attend to. Thank you for joining us on Divorce at Altitude. I look forward to seeing what else we come up with in terms of estate planning. And it's always going to be fun stuff for us divorce lawyers to track all that. And we'll have you come back on and explain all that. But until then, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, guys. This has been fun.
Hey everyone, this is Ryan again. Thank you for joining us on Divorce at Altitude. If you found our tips, insight, or discussion helpful, please tell a friend about this podcast. For show notes, additional resources, or links mentioned on today's episode, visit divorceataltitude.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen in. Many of our episodes are also posted on YouTube. You can also find Amy and me at kalamea.law or 970-315-2365. That's kalamaya.law.